When I am hostile or rebellious toward God, what I am saying is, God, I don't really think you have my best interest in mind. God, I don't like your design. God, I really don't want it to be that way, and in fact, I won't have it your way. I know what's good for me. You may not know what's good for me really as well as I do, so I'm just going to go my direction.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKinsey Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In these weekly broadcasts of Christianity at Work, Jack and Christine will strive together in an extemporaneous dialogue to understand the practical issues, questions, and struggles of everyday life in the light of the truth of the gospel. Here now are Jack and Christine, continuing their series on biblical sexual ethics.
Here we are again looking at sexuality and trying to lay a foundation for looking at our sexuality and how we live as sexual beings in the world. A really, really important subject, because our sexuality is a really great part of what God gave us to live with, and it's a real struggle to live according to God's design with our sexuality, especially with the whole world blaring at us and saying, use our sexuality in ways that really, I think from a biblical perspective, we were never intended to use it. So we really need to be grounded in what our sexuality is about. And therefore, you and I are just spending a whole lot of time on sexuality, probably many, many weeks, and perhaps even months. To begin, for the first four programs, we looked at a biblical theory of sexuality. In our last program, we looked at a biblical sexual ethic. We looked at, actually, biblical ethics, and then tried to apply that to our sexuality. And we're going to continue that again today. Part of the reason for that is that you and I need to be able to, when we're looking in the face of some big temptation, be able to understand our answer and answer it consistent with God's design. And when we're teaching our children, we need to give them a basis from which to think about their sexuality as children, as adolescents, and later throughout their whole life.
Right.
Just to summarize what we said last week, we said that God made the world and made us with a very particular design. And we need to understand that design and live according to it. Understand God, who He is, and live our lives according to our understanding of who He is. However, we're sinners. And in our sinfulness, we do perverse things. We think in perverse ways. We do wrong things. In other words, we are very naturally hostile to God's design. There's a number of ways that we're hostile to God's design. And we started last week with saying one of the ways that our sinfulness or our hostility toward God shows itself is that we don't care about God's character. And lots of times we don't care about God's values. What we do is disregard His goodness and His purity, and we disregard His wanting us to be loving people and act in a way that's just selfish, that's just doing what we want and heading in the direction that we want it.
Right. I do want to back up for just a second and reemphasize again, because the picture is so seductive that the way to think about ethics in this world is to think about whether or not I'm living in harmony with God's design. That's roughly true. I mean, I think that's roughly accurate. But if we emphasize that too strongly, then we miss the whole point of what the Bible is getting at. And that is not that we disregard God's design, but that we disregard God Himself. It's taken me years to make that transition, and so that's why I'm harping on this, because it really does, in the end, make a big difference whether or not my life is all about loving God or making the world work for me. That's the fundamental issue. And it's important to see that from a biblical perspective, my life is all about learning to love God and be rightly related to Him. The way that works itself out is how I behave in relationship not only to Him, but my fellow creatures and the world itself. It's to the extent that that reflects my attitude toward God that makes it right, wrong, or perverse, or whatever.
So, Jack, yeah, last time you came back to this because you really do think it's important, and here we are again with you trying to make that distinction.
Yeah. I'm not making the distinction because I'm totally rejecting the kind of language you use, because I think for the most part, in many, many respects, to talk about violating God's design, I will probably go on to speak in that language later as we talk about some of the different specific ethical issues. I think it's okay to talk that way, but ultimately I just want to make the point right up front. Ultimately, what's wrong about disregarding God's design is because I can't disregard God's design without also disregarding God the designer. And at the root of what makes evil evil is that disregarding of God. That's why it's so horrendous to disregard God's design.
So it isn't that me having an extramarital affair is in itself the only problem, although it does have bad consequences in my life, and it is objectively wrong. What's really wrong about having that extramarital affair is that I'm saying, God, I don't care about you.
Right. Remember in David's psalm, the psalm that he writes where he's praying to God after his adulterous relationship with Bathsheba, he has a line in there, God, against you and you only I have sinned, something like that.
Yes.
That's the spirit of what I'm trying to get at, is that just like the physical creation that God created, my body, for example, take my body, it can take a lot of abuse and still survive. I can get a virus and I can get a bacterial infection, and any number of things can happen that are not exactly fun, but my body adjusts, it compensates, it, you know, rearranges whatever it needs to rearrange to get itself healthy again. I think the human psyche is for the most part that way as well. We can undergo all kinds of, be victims of a lot of injustice and abuse and so on, and manage to survive in this life. We don't have this kind of rigid, you know, universe where if you transgress at one point, you literally self-destruct and you're dead. Sometimes we can think along those lines with that kind of picture of reality, that I dare not transgress the design of the universe, because if I transgress the design of the universe, something just really absolutely horrendous is going to happen. Sometimes, take sexuality for example, I transgress the laws of the universe. I commit adultery or premarital sexual relationships or something. I commit fornication or adultery, and I come out the other end, and I might feel vaguely guilty, but I seem to have survived. Okay, what have I done? Have I somehow beaten the odds? Have I somehow beaten God's universe? No. There's enough resiliency and enough flexibility in the human psyche that I can survive having violated the design for my sexuality that God created. But whether I survive or not, I have demonstrated an incredible disregard for and, yea, even hostility toward God the designer. So I have sinned against Him, even if I haven't ultimately sinned against myself, even if I haven't ultimately sinned against my spouse. Another example, I commit adultery, but no one ever knows. My spouse never finds out. It's the secret that I have hidden. Can I, by keeping it a secret, somehow manage to make it right? Because there will be no consequences, because how people would be expected to respond to that, they don't ever have to respond to it because it's just never known. No, because my committing an adultery is an offense against the designer, even if it doesn't ever translate into a concrete offense against other people in the world.
And it's an offense I have at least made in my heart. And my heart toward God is saying, I don't care about your design. It doesn't matter to me. It didn't hurt. I don't think it hurt me. I don't think it hurt the other person. But I think you could really argue with that. I think any time we do transgress,
yeah,
it is hurting us, even if it's not apparent to us.
Right.
But
well, that's why your example is better. What about adultery in my mind, where I never act on it? Your point is, that attitude is an offense against my designer, against the creator, even if I never act on it in a way that has any consequences, that I'm never actually transgressing the design in the universe. But never mind, I would if I could. And that in of itself is that hostility toward God that is at the root of what makes evil evil.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, let's look at the other ways that we can show our hostility toward God, how it comes out in our lives.
We don't like to think of ourselves as fools or as being foolish. Although we might entertain the thought while jesting with our close friends or family, being called a fool doesn't sit well with our vulnerable self-images. The Bible, however, makes it abundantly clear that you and I are members in good standing of a class of beings characterized as foolish. That is the opening paragraph of Wes Hurd's News and Views article, What Kind of Fool Are You? In this article, Wes demonstrates how the Bible draws a line between two kinds of fools: those who are foolish because they disbelieve the gospel, and those who are fools for Christ. To believe the good news of God's salvation for mankind is to believe in something that the world sees as foolish. Believing the gospel often means suffering. It means facing into one's own evil and guilt. It means seeing the death that Christ suffered is a death we all deserve. We might decide to turn from God and seek happiness and success in the world. In God's eyes, this would be true foolishness. So, who are you going to believe? Or more importantly, what kind of fool are you? You can find this article and more at the McKenzie Study Center website, or call and ask for the free copy, 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801.
And Jack, we're talking a lot about hostility toward God, and we're looking at four ways that we act out in a hostile way toward God. Is another word, a word that we could use synonymously, would rebellion work here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are there any other synonyms that may work as well as hostility?
Antagonism, opposition. Of course, one of the terms is the opposite of love is hatred, and the term that gets used most often in the Bible is an encouragement that we need to love God. The opposite of that, of course, is hatred.
And what about fear? Would that be another one?
Fear is used positively. Is that what you mean?
Well, there's a positive fear and a negative fear. Love casts out all fear.
Yeah. Uh huh. To fear God is to not not be comfortable with Him, and to not really know Him, to not really trust Him. That's all part of the picture of this suspicion and hostility toward God.
Okay. Now, in our sexuality, we can be very antagonistic or rebellious toward God. What's a second way that we can do that? We talked about not seeing God's character or understanding or valuing what God values. That's our first category. What's the second?
Okay. The second would be the one that keeps coming up, and that would be to be hostile to God's created design in the world. So particularly when it comes to sexuality, to really disregard what God created and intended sexuality to be and the role that He intended it to play in our lives. So that if we transgress that, then our hostility toward what He's done is ultimately a hostility toward Him Himself. Particularly, we've spent several sessions talking about what I called a biblical theory of sexuality, where I tried to lay out what it is that God has designed sexuality for. And what I argued is that ultimately sexuality is a language that God has built into the human psyche, a language whereby we can use my body to say something to another person. Specifically, I say to that person, I'm giving you my life, I'm giving you my all, I'm committing myself to be one with you for the rest of our lives, in effect to restate and ratify a biblical marriage vow. And that's what it's for, roughly. I mean, we need to talk, it's more complicated than that, and we need to talk about that, but that's for the large, in large part what it's about. if we decide, no, I want my sexuality to be having babies, or I want my sexuality to be about pleasure, or I want my sexuality to be about power, or any number of other things that we could do with my sexuality, in effect, what I'm saying to God is, God, I've thought about this, and I see a lot of potential in my sexuality to do something else with it than rather than what you want me to do with it. And I'm cleverer than you are, so I'm going to go with my idea and not stick with your idea.
Okay, so let me think about something kind of subtle. Let's have a Christian woman who's married and very much wants to be in a good relationship with her husband. However, she works at some public place and notices that it really is to her advantage to dress in a way that's a little bit seductive. Maybe not overtly so, but somewhat. And finds that that does give her some attention that's enjoyable to her. Maybe gives her a little bit of edge on decision making. Maybe gets people to pay attention to her some. And so she is using her sexuality not in a very overt way, in a way that maybe anybody could pin her down to, but nonetheless she's using her sexuality as outside the design that God intended it.
Absolutely. Exactly. That's a great example. She's decided that her sexuality can cause professional advancement and decides to use it for that. And that's not what it's for. And so to the extent that I, consciously or unconsciously determine in my own heart that that's what I'm going to use my sexuality for, I'm stepping outside of the purpose that God intended it for.
Okay, let me come up with another example, because lots of times we think about stepping outside of God's design for a sexuality as being something very big, like having extramarital affair, or having premarital sex, or being very interested and involved in pornography on the internet with pornography, other kinds of materials, looking at movies that are Z-rated. I don't know if they're Z-rated movies, but
Yeah, should be.
Whatever they are, yeah. And, we think of very obvious things, but I think what I'm trying to get at here is also trying to speak to the subtleties that even a person that wants to pursue God may find themselves involved in, because in our culture, the perversity of our sexuality is so out there that it's sometimes easy for us to be blind to or miss or even justify some of the things that we do. So in my example, I talked about dress, but I think even more subtle is an attitude. And in one of our programs, we talked about needing to be, if we're married, to be very married. And what I mean by that is in my attitude toward men, I, Christine, need to have an understanding and a backdrop that I am married to my husband, that I don't offer, even in my attitude, in my looks, in my heart, any kind of invitation toward you to view me as a person, as a sexual person. I'm not to be a sexual person toward you, Jack,
right,
or anyone else except for my husband, not in any way.
Yeah, that's well said and much needed in our culture, I think. Because the cultural assumption is that we are always sexual people toward everybody, and in fact, in practice, many people are sexual in relationship to everybody, and I don't. It's really hard to pin down exactly what it is, but you know it when you see it.
You feel it.
And we need to avoid that. We need to be. To be able to come across to people as unavailable and therefore asexual, in a sense, in our relationships to other people, except in the context of marriage. Because that's where sex is appropriate. That's what it's for. That's where it is this language of commitment that is meaningful then.
And I think we really need to be looking out for it. I noticed in my own life that I grew up pretty square. I think in another program I talked about really not seeing myself as female or male, but kind of as a neutral person. So in my quest to develop my sense of my own sexuality, one of the things I have done is gone from even the colors I wear that were, I think, ugly on me. For me, brown and burnt orange were ugly, and I always wore those before, and just to wearing different colors, softer colors sometimes, and different cuts in my clothes with my husband, so that I would just kind of have a sense of my femaleness. It's easy then to want to go out to dinner with my husband and be that kind of sexual person, because my sexuality is alive to me. I like it. But even recently, I've noticed I need to back up and leave some of my clothes at home, because even shorter skirts that are in now, for me, can make me so aware of my sexuality that I can be communicating something other than what's right and what's good. I might be wanting to be only sexual with my husband, but it can't but give a different impression to other people. And so I guess what I'm talking about is let's be aware. Let's continue to be aware. Let's not ever have it as a settled subject.
Yeah, that's good. A very obvious hostility to God's created design would be something like homosexuality, and I think probably we should reserve some longer time for discussion about that later. But I think from a biblical perspective, that's a very obvious way in which we can rebel against God's created order, because God's created order involves heterosexual sexual relationships, not homosexual relationships. So to the extent that I say, God, what a terrible idea, you don't really understand how much potential there is in my sexuality, I could even have sex with a member of the same sex and make that work for me. So God, you're just being unreasonably restrictive to reserve that for heterosexuality.
And for that person, it isn't obvious at all that that's being rebellious toward God. For them,
right.
It could look like, you know, this really is legitimate. This really is right. And certainly in our culture, it is being more and more legitimized.
Right. That raises a very important issue. And that is, I'm using language like hostility and hatred and opposition to God. We typically don't experience it that way. We don't even think in terms of, I shouldn't say never, but typically we don't think of it in terms of, I hate God and I'm going to go off and resist him. The biblical perspective is trying to give us some insight into what really is ultimately going on. It's not necessarily the level at which I consciously experience it, and it's important to see that. Because just because I don't feel hostile toward God doesn't mean that what I'm doing is not, in fact, a horrendous sort of hostility toward God. It is that, whether I feel it or not.
Yeah, I might not even be thinking of God at all.
Exactly.
Or, you know, I'm thinking about the myself going out to dinner in a dress that really does is too seductive. I'm not thinking I want to be hostile toward God. I'm thinking I enjoy my sexuality and I'm enjoying my husband and I'm going to go out. But in a subtle way, I really am going in the wrong direction.
Right.
There is a very important line that needs to be drawn here. And the woman who's making some very subtle, seductive advances toward men at her work may not in any way even see herself as being hostile toward God. But it is an objective reality that it is hostile toward God if it isn't according to his design. And we need to keep coming back to that.
Yeah, the most typical form of being hostile to God is to disregard God. So consciously, the fact that we're not even thinking of God is a large part of the problem. We're not even putting our decision and our action and our attitudes in the context of there's a God who's there and I need to be dealing with him. I need to be concerned about him. Precisely because we're not thinking in those terms, that's at the root of the hostility.
Okay, two ways that we're rebellious toward God. One is in our failure of understanding God, his character,
his
goodness, his values, the fact that he is a loving and good God. The second one is the way that we're hostile toward God is that we
rebel against the created order, the design in his creation.
And the third way?
Third way is to be hostile to God's purposes. The term the Bible uses for this kind of hostility is worldliness. And what I mean is this, that from a biblical perspective, God has put us here on this earth as a kind of, is a temporary existence that's a it's a stepping stone to what he really wants my existence to be about for all of eternity. So that I really have a choice to make about this existence that I now find myself in. I can look at this as transitional in my existence to something above and beyond, or I can look at this and say, this'll do, let me sink my roots deep and invest myself here and now in this reality that I'm in right now and make my existence all about now. And we kind of, in a stubborn, resistant, rebellious kind of way, can say to God, look, this is what I want. I want what I can get out of this world right now. There are a lot of good things you've put here, and as long as you let me use my imagination and have my own ideas about how to get the goods out of this world, I think I can be satisfied with what I've got right now. Well, God had never intended me to be satisfied with this existence I've got right now. And what he wanted me to do, what he wants me to do, is to see this world and this existence as transitional to something much better, much bigger, much more beyond on now.
So, Jack,
that's the right attitude to take.
So how do I live in the world now if what God wants me to see is that this world is transitional, that this isn't all there is to it?
I enjoy it, but I don't invest in it. I am delighted by the good things in this world, but I don't seek to find the very meaning of my existence in the enjoyment of those things. I can, in a sense, take it or leave it. As it comes, I'm grateful for the good and wonderful, delightful things that it has to offer. But if I'm deprived of those good and wonderful and delightful things, that's okay too, because there's more and better stuff coming.
Okay, so let me apply this to sexuality. So it's possible that it's not possible. Let me use an example from my own life. It'd be better. I am a married woman, and I very much enjoy my sexuality. I like to nurture it. I embrace it. I work at making it a good part of my life. I enjoy it. However, it can't be the sum and substance of what my life is about or even what my marriage is about. It can be a part of my life that I really enjoy, but not all of it.
Right. Yeah, what the person who tries to find something in this life that they enjoy and get delight from or get pleasure from and make that the sum and substance of their life, the end result for them is almost always boredom. Because in the end, after you've pursued the same thing to the bitter end, there's nothing left. There's a hollowness to it.
There's a hollowness to it. I agree with you, unless what you do is you keep on, in this context, becoming more and more and more perverse.
Right, right.
And that's certainly what we've done in our culture. We've made sex such a big end-all, at least some of us have, that we have become more and more perverse.
We have to get kinkier and kinkier in order to get the same result in terms of pleasure and satisfaction. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Let's take a break.
The ministry of Mackenzie Study Center is founded on a passionate desire to confront the truth of the gospel. Over the years, Mackenzie has offered classes, seminars, tutorials, counseling, conferences, and more to interested individuals. The staff at Mackenzie also write and offer to you the free monthly newsletter, News and Views. You might want to check out the News and Views titled, Bible Study for What Ails Us by Dr. Jack Crabtree. Jack takes on the popular sentiment that says being a Christian is just about loving Jesus and not about believing the right doctrine. Jack argues that although knowing the right doctrine is not enough to secure one's salvation, turning away from the pursuit of truth will lead one down the path of false spirituality. He says, from a human perspective, the only way any of us is going to survive is by grounding ourselves in the truth. The best way we can become grounded in the truth is by becoming grounded in the teaching of the Bible. And the only way we can become grounded in the teaching of the Bible is by making its study a priority. Call Mackenzie Study Center and get your copy of Bible Study for What Ails Us. The phone number is 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now, back to Jack and Christine.
Jack, will you go back now and review the different ways that we said that we are hostile toward God, and then go on to the last one.
Okay. The first one we looked at is that we can express our hostility toward God through our hostility to His own character, specifically His character of being a God of love, by showing hostility toward the need to be loving. We are showing our hostility toward God. We can show hostility, and I'm still on the same point related to that, hostility to His own values. God is a God of truth. God is a God of goodness. God is a God of purity. God is a God of integrity and wholeness. To the extent that I disregard purity and goodness and truth and wholeness and all of that, I'm disregarding God and His values and everything He stands for. So the first point is I can be hostile toward God by being hostile to His character and His values. The second thing, I can be hostile toward God by being hostile toward the world and the reality that He designed in accordance with the design that He designed it. To the extent that I think I could design it better or rearrange it or recreate it, to that extent I'm rebelling against God Himself. And then the last thing that we mentioned is that I can be hostile toward God's purposes. God has created this world to be temporary and transitional. To the extent that I prefer it to be permanent, to be the permanent nature of my existence, to that extent I'm rebelling against His purpose for this world. And that's what the Bible calls worldliness and ultimately is hostility toward God Himself. Then finally, it seems to me that we can be hostile toward God by being hostile toward His role as our provider and protector and sustainer. God is really the one who, by all rights, I should trust to take care of me and to manage my life and to make sure that I'm provided for and protected and kept safe and so on. And therefore, the appropriate response to God would be to trust Him with my entire life and every detail of my life. But in fact, to the extent that we don't trust God with every detail of my life, to that extent, I'm showing hostility toward Him. No, God, I'd rather do it myself. I'm going to go out and take care of myself. I don't know if You care about me enough to leave my life in Your hands. I know that I care about me, so I may not be as competent as You, God, but at least I'm interested in me, so I'm going to take care of myself. And that lack of trust is ultimately one more species of my rebellion and hostility and antagonism toward God.
So trusting God as a married man who has a very unsatisfying sexual relationship with his wife could mean that he has to live with that unsatisfying relationship with his wife and trusting that that's what God has for him. Not necessarily even trusting that God's going to make it very good one day, hoping perhaps, praying perhaps that it will be so, but accepting the reality that it may not be so.
Precisely. It's a great example. Yeah. Another example that comes to mind that's a little bit different, but it really was important in my life to help me see how vital trust in God can be and how much difference it can make. Because oftentimes trust in God cannot, in fact, usually trust in God cannot be defined in terms of what actions to take. The actions that I take might be perfectly good in and of themselves, but they can be actions that manifest my lack of trust in God and therefore are wrong. Let me illustrate that. When I was first getting to know my wife, when I was first trying to come to terms with the reality that I was one day going to marry her and trying to make that decision, and I think I had this sense of inevitability that I was going to marry this woman someday, but from that sense of inevitability that you're going to marry them to actually agreeing with one another that you're going to do that can be a very, very clumsy process, as it was in my case.
I'm thinking about you stumbling down a hill that's very steep and you can't stop yourself.
Exactly. It always feels that way. And it's fraught with all kinds of fears and insecurities. And I thought I knew that my wife was interested in me. But, you never know for sure.
You mean that your girlfriend or your friend was interested in you at that point?
The woman who eventually became my wife. I thought that she was interested in me. But, I didn't know for sure. I would see her relating to other guys, and she liked them too. So, where was I exactly? Where did I stand in her eyes? And I came home one night and was just so tortured by uncertainty and fear and anxiety about where I stood that I wanted to go call her. And I wanted I realized before I picked up the phone and dialed it, I realized that what I wanted from her is something that she couldn't possibly give me. That is, what I really wanted is a crystal ball where I could look into the future and I could see exactly where this relationship was going to end. Or, short of a crystal ball, a prophet would have been okay too. If God would have sent a prophet and said, Jack, you will marry this woman, or Jack, you will not marry this woman, then I would know where I stood and I would know, I could be at ease, exactly. I could do away with my anxiety, which was torturing me and was really bugging me. Well, Jody was neither a prophet nor a crystal ball. She undoubtedly was just as confused and just as uncertain as I was. So the question I had to ask myself is, Jack, why would you put the burden of your anxiety on her? You know, what are you going to do her? Are you going to somehow manipulate out of her the answer to your future, and therefore to quell your fears that way? That's what I wanted to do. And yet I realized that that would have been incredibly unloving and unfair to her, because she's in no position any more than I am to have an answer to these questions. But I had this irresistible urge to pick up the phone and talk to her. I wanted to shift the burden off of me onto her.
You wanted to take away your anxiety. You didn't want to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, precisely. And I so much wanted to get rid of that anxiety that I wanted to give it a chance. I wanted to make that phone call and see if it would work. And I literally had to sit on my hands to keep from dialing the phone. But it was a very, very important lesson to me. And that was in two respects. Just because something in and of itself is not wrong to do, namely make a phone call, you know, I could have easily rationalized that. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm just making a phone call. I mean, what can be wrong with that? But I wasn't just making a phone call. I was shifting the burden of my anxiety off of me onto her. And that would have been very unloving, and ultimately, it was a lack of trust. Because what I was how should I have resolved my anxiety? By saying, there's a God in heaven who's in control of my life, and in his good time, he's going to make it clear to you what your future holds, Jack. Until then, just relax in the knowledge that he has your best interest in mind, and he's not going to destroy you. This will work out. However it works out, it's going to work out to your best interest. So relax as best you can in the understanding that that's true. And if that doesn't take away all your anxieties, then live with your anxieties, Jack. But just sit there. That's where God's got you. Trust him that he knows what he's doing.
You know, I can't tell you how many times I tell people in counseling. They'll tell me how anxious they are, how much discomfort they feel, and I'll say, yeah, you're mm-hmm. just going to have to live uncomfortable. That's right. But I can't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll just say, well, that's what probably this calls for.
Mm-hmm.
Life isn't about just getting rid of feeling bad.
Right.
Sometimes trusting God means having to trust God with how bad we feel, how anxious we are. But the point you were making is, it wasn't necessarily the behavior. Making a phone call is no big deal. In fact, in some circumstances, making a phone call would be exactly the right thing to do.
Yeah, I called her the next morning when I had dealt with my anxiety another way. Now I was free to actually just communicate with her.
And just keep on with the relationship and let it go as it would, rather than trying to force it.
Right.
Great example.
And that's the subtlety of this evil, is that it can transform literally any good thing in this world into an evil thing. That virtually anything can become some kind of manifestation of my failure to trust God and believe that he has my best interest in mind and relax in that.
So it looks like what we've come to the end of looking at how we are hostile toward God.
And in saying that, what I've outlined is, I think, all the category of all the ways in which evil can be evil in our lives from a biblical perspective. That in these four ways, the things that the Bible calls wrong are wrong for one or more of these four reasons. It's either because we are disregarding the character of God, the created design of the created order of God, God's purposes, or God's role as our provider, and we're not trusting Him. In one of those four ways, if the Bible says that something is sin, the reason it calls it sin is because it's demonstrating hostility toward God in one of those four ways.
So anytime I sin, I could really say I'm sinning in one of these ways.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
And let me,
or one or more.
Mm-hmm. One or more of these ways.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, but let me point out one more time that it may not be a sin that I'm even aware of. It may not be that I'm hostile in a sense that, I mean, we use the word hostility as a very aggressive term. And that's not necessarily how we experience it, how other people experience it. It could look very passive. We even could be looking very loving, or very, like your phone call example, could be a very neutral looking thing.
Right.
So when we talk about hostility, it's not that we have this, you know, our fangs out or our claws out or we're beating somebody up. It could be far, far more subtle than that.
Right. So this was all general ethics. We want to talk about sexuality. The thing to keep in mind as we get into talking about what's wrong and right about the way we behave sexually, what I'm arguing is that ultimately what the Bible is saying is we need to behave sexually in a way that doesn't violate any of these four things, that doesn't demonstrate hostility toward God in any of these areas. And I want to explore the way in which the various things that we do violate one or more of these four things.
So the ways that we sin sexually do violate these four areas.
Right.
Okay.
But before we go there, I said in a past session that one of the things that is interesting to me about this is so that I as a parent and we as parents can be equipped to help our children learn how to deal with their sexuality. You know, one objection that could be raised is, okay, so Jack, you're telling me that I'm going to tell my adolescent child the reason that you shouldn't engage in premarital sex is because you're demonstrating your hostility toward God in one of four ways. and we will be more specific. But even spelling out the specifics of that requires that my child be responsive to something like, well, if you abuse your sexuality, then you don't have integrity. You're violating the integrity of who you are if you abuse your sexuality. You're telling me that's going to be effective? You're telling me that's going to work, Jack? And I don't want to give any false promises. No, I'm not saying that's going to work. I'm saying it should work.
Ideally.
And I'm saying that we should try to instill in our children a kind of respect for the kinds of things that the Bible respects so that they will be responsive to that, so that they will see the value of that. But there are no guarantees. If my child, in my child's own rebellion against God, has just decided, you know, all that integrity and wholeness and trust stuff is just garbage. I mean, that's just nonsense stuff. What this life is really all about is feeling good. That's a choice that they're going to make, and there's really not much I can do about that. If they've decided to rebel against God with abandon, then they've decided to rebel against God with abandon, and all the talk in the world, all the reminder in the world of what our life and existence is all about is really not going to change their minds. Ultimately, all of us come to obedience, as we've said before, because God has touched my heart and has supernaturally performed a work in my heart where my heart becomes tender toward the things that it should be tender toward. I look at truth and I value truth. I look at goodness and I value goodness. I value virtue. I value integrity. I value purity because with my own eyes I've begun to see that they really are valuable in their own right. And it's only when I get to be that kind of person that anything that we're going to have to say from here on out is really going to have much power with me.
Okay. You know, when you say there's no guarantee, I know that, but everything inside me thinks about my own children, my own three children, and think, no,
yeah.
I know. I want to have some guarantee so that they make good decisions in regard to their sexuality, because it matters so much. There's so much at stake here. I want you to say, this is how to do it, and I want you to tell me it's going to work. And I don't like that you just said nothing will necessarily, quote unquote, work. But I think one of the ways that we as parents try to make it work, and let me explain this to you. I think that we work very hard at controlling our children, at making it so they will not make a decision that's going against what we want. We so control them, their thoughts, their actions, and we do that perhaps out of fear. They fear us, so they never even think about what they want to think about. They don't make their own decisions. They just follow obediently only, kind of mindlessly obediently, what we want for them. And in one way, that's very comforting to a parent. I really see why parents raise their children that way. It's in some ways so much more comfortable just to have a kid that's just doing what we want them to do and looking good to the outside world. A problem with that is they are not developing a sense of their own identity. They're not developing an understanding of how to think about things, they're not becoming wise people that can enter into life and make decisions that they're going to need to make. They're going to come up against decisions, and at some point, just blind obedience isn't going to really matter.
Yeah.
It's all going to come home someday.
Yeah, the value that we can be instilling in them is, don't make me unhappy. And my happiness can be the value that they have owned and made their own. But that just doesn't cut it in the real world in the long run. That the values that they need to embrace are to value truth and integrity and goodness and purity and so on, and to really have made those values, inculcated those values within themselves and made them their own, really, really taken ownership for those. To the extent that I, as a parent, can induce them to do that, to that extent, I'm doing them a wonderful favor. But instead, we are satisfied with the counterfeit. I can make it look like they have embraced those values by simply me dictating to them what I want them to do, and for the only value that they've really owned is, I don't want my father to be unhappy with me. And that just doesn't, in the long run, cut it.
It doesn't cut it.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly was a very, very obedient kid in some ways. But, boy, I really hit the hard world. And it didn't cut it. That's what my dad wanted for me. It mm-hmm. didn't cut it at all. And I really had to go back and have to learn how to think and have to learn about what I wanted and why I wanted. And it's very, very sloppy. It's sloppy as an adult and it's sloppy as a kid. But what we're talking about here is, Jack, a whole way of parenting. And we need to, there's parents out there just screaming to know, how do I parent? And the way that we're talking about parenting here is that we're not controlling our kids. What we're trying to do is help our kids see life, understand life, work with the variables of life. And in the midst of them doing that, they're going to look sloppier as they grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to make us look as good.
Yeah, I do think there's a time and place to control your kids. I like to think I want them to survive long enough to make up their own mind about what life is all about. So as the younger they are, the more appropriate it is to simply protect them and control them. As long as I don't make that my ultimate the ultimate way of dealing with them. As you say, I ultimately need to let them own their own values. And if I'm not headed there, then I'm making a big mistake.
Well, I wish we had a lot more time, because I think this control, not control, is a very important subject.
Yeah.
I really concur with you that there is a time in life when kids need that for their own safety. And we as parents need to learn how to lessen and lessen and lessen that, so that we're encouraging them to think about and to look at life and become people who know how to think and have developed and established their own sense of identity and what's right and wrong.
It's probably a whole nother series that we're going to have to do.
Yes.
Almost 20 years ago, the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, Mackenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant, a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The Mackenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. They desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Information about how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
In the next session, we will get into some specifics about what the Bible calls wrong when it comes to the way I employ my sexuality and what the Bible calls right in terms of how I employ my sexuality. What we've done in this session and the session prior to this is try to lay a groundwork, a foundation for our discussion about the specifics of our sexuality by just simply asking the question, why does the Bible call wrong what it calls wrong? And what I have proposed is that it ultimately comes down to a very simple point, and that is evil is the hatred of God, is the rejection of God, is the disrespect and hostility and stubborn opposition to God that comes so naturally to us. That opposition to God manifests itself in a number of different ways, but at root, at the heart of it, it always comes down to, I don't like God, I don't like what God is doing, I don't like the way he's made the world, I don't like the way he's running the world, and I want to do it my own way. That's fundamentally what evil always amounts to. And I laid out four specific ways in which I think that stubbornness and hostility toward God manifests itself. We actually reject his character. We don't like his character. He's a God of love, but we don't like that enough to emulate that. We don't like his values. He's a God who values truth and goodness and purity and wholeness and integrity. Those are things that we don't particularly have that much regard for. We prefer things like pleasure and convenience and a lack of suffering in life. Those are higher values to us than truth, goodness, and purity. So God's character and values are we rebel against or we're hostile toward. We're hostile toward the created order that he designed. We don't like its design. We don't like its purposes. We don't like the way he's structured it. So we would like to restructure it and redesign it. So, for example, our sexuality, we don't like what he designed it for. We'd rather have it be for something else. And so we try to live out our lives making our sexuality for something else. We don't like his purpose. He created this world to be a transitional, temporary staging point for another level of existence. We don't like that fact. We'd rather just live here permanently. And then finally, we don't respect the fact that God is our provider and our protector and our nurturer, someone to be trusted, and we prefer to think of ourselves as our own protector, and we'd rather trust ourselves rather than trust God. In all of those ways, we demonstrate our hostility toward God, and whenever the Bible calls something sin, what I'm arguing is, I think at root, it calls it sin because it comes back to manifesting one of those four ways of being rebellious against God.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.